Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. One thing I wanted to bring up to start our conversation today was the topic of American food. I often get asked by international friends, what is American food? American food for many people is hamburgers, hot dogs, kind of the cheap food, poor nutrition, not much value, and really no idea of where the sourcing's coming from. I kind of look at it differently, and I look at this in the fact that we have such a unique opportunity to embrace the diverse cuisines that we have in this country. America, after all, is the melting pot, and we have an opportunity to capture folks from all over the world, from different backgrounds with their cuisines and truly different types of foods that they source. And so I do look at that, what American food could be, and maybe try to find something that could be a great unifier, which could be sourcing, could be looking at how the way we bring food together and embrace those cuisines the way that we can embrace each other. So that I want to lead into that conversation for our guest today. Our guest today, who is a James Beard award-winning chef. She is the owner and proprietor of Oleana, Sofra, and Sarma Restaurants. Today we welcome Anna Sortoon. Anna, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Well, you know, it's fun for us to come into a recording studio and talk because we get a chance to catch up on occasion. And I'm always impressed by the stuff that you're working on, mostly because you continuously push the envelope in what chefs and master chefs are doing. So first question I got for you, and I'm going to lead this in right away because you are a world-renowned chef when it comes to Turkish cuisine and Middle Eastern cuisine and, you know, getting to this point of what is American food and how can Americans embrace these things. I want to show one quick anecdote that I think is key to lead up to this. Is we had a chance to have dinner in Istanbul, and we were at the Salt Bazaar. And let me just preface this by saying I had eaten a bunch of street food in Istanbul, so I was not feeling so well. I learned my mistake. I think here I am thinking I'm like Anthony Bourdain, that I can eat whatever I want, but I haven't developed that iron gut. But Anna, you were nice enough to welcome me into your family. You had friends and family there for this big dinner. And this chef, this famous chef in Turkey comes up and couldn't be more thrilled to have you there. Having you sign his book, signed your book for him. It was incredible. I was sitting there, I was overwhelmed, and you just took it in stride. I was so impressed by the way you handle it from these people that were just kind of almost a fandom. There was a fanboy element going on for this guy with what you created. And so the question I have leading into that is, how does a Scandinavian woman or a woman of Scandinavian descent, I think you are of Scandinavian descent, from the Pacific Northwest become a world-renowned leader in Turkish cuisine?
I know it doesn't make any sense at all. And thank you for your kind words. That was very sweet of you. I honestly don't feel as though I've got that sort of clout or renowned reputation for all that. But I'm really honored, and I am grateful for the kind words. But I think my whole family scratches their head about how I got to where I am today. What is a Norwegian doing cooking Turkish food? But, you know, there's cuisine, and then there's food, and, you know, this whole sort of can of worms opened for me when I knew at a very young age I wanted to cook. I was 14, and it was my first job, and I pursued it. My mother, I don't have that romantic story of my mother, you know, growing up, she was the best cook, and she made, you know, it wasn't that romantic Italian grandmother story either. But my mom did cook, and she was a stickler for really good ingredients. And so I think that planted the seed for me early on. And I sort of realized, well, I really love to eat, and I really love to eat well. And if I want to do this for the rest of my life, I got to learn more about it. I've got to really learn how to cook too. So my first job was in a restaurant, and that led me to really fall in love with the actual work of being in a kitchen. And I went to France at an early age to study cooking. But, you know, it wasn't until maybe 10 years ago, way later in my career, I remember my father always asking me this question, you know, well, why do you have to go to school in France? Why can't you go to school here? And, you know, a lot of that was just this parent not wanting their child to go off into the world kind of thing, because I was very young. I was 19. And I never really could answer that question other than I knew this is what I was going to do. There was no other way to learn, as far as I'm concerned. If you want to learn how to cook, you go to France. So maybe about 10 years ago, I was really able to kind of get to the bottom of what was it that I learned in France that I couldn't really learn as easily here in the United States. And that was really just the respect and the honor and the seasonality and the focus on really good, pure ingredients. And again, I was 19, so that seed was planted pretty young too. So, I mean, I think in combination of the two, really good ingredients, really good food has always been really important to me. And honestly, as a chef, the cuisine part is very interesting to me. I love the flavors and all that, but when it comes to technique or sort of manipulating something a lot by, you know, using a lot of science or, you know, really fancy knife skills, I'm just sort of like, it's not as interesting to me as just really pure, honest, unmanipulated flavor.
Hmm. And I guess when you got it, you got it. And I think you're very humble in the way you describe it, because I think you must have a unique ability to taste things, and for you they make sense. It's like when a musician hears notes, they can recite them quite quickly. I've been to all your restaurants. I know the quality that you produce. So I'm sure there's a certain level of you have this intrinsic skill, and you're able to take in and mesh that with where you're at. So do you find that you had a natural skill growing up, or was it something you really did cultivate from your time in France or from your time working from, I also read that you started as a dishwasher and worked your way up to then MasterChef and then owner of these fine restaurants?
Yeah, well, I think early on, I just really loved to eat. That was it. I really loved to eat good food. I mean, I was that kid that would have had two dinners if I could, like, one it early on and one later before bed. You know, it was just always such a pleasure. And I think I did have a grandmother that made a lot of things from scratch. Again, very simple cooking, but, you know, she churned her own butter and she, you know, made her own bread and those kinds of things. You know, once you have that in you, you can't really go back. And I never really developed a taste for, you know, fast food, even though, you know, it was interesting. And it was sort of like, okay, we got that when the babysitter was hanging out with us or something. It was like a treat, you know.
Totally,
but
yeah,
I think it was just early on the seed was planted. But yeah, I think the work ethic part is what really drew me in. I actually really loved the work of being on my feet and doing things with my hands. And I didn't, you know, I got to move around. The day just flew by and I had fun doing it.
Do you know the idea of the super taster? I just learned about this a little ago. My mom's a super taster. I guess if you taste cilantro as soap, you're a super taster, right? And you have this unique sense of smell. I think we smell. We pass that along to our son, who can just sniff anything and be like, no, I'm good. I don't want to touch that anyhow. So you must have some level of super taster in you to be able to put these complex flavors together. Because that's at least what I've seen in some of this Middle Eastern cuisine is you have an abundance of spices, an abundance of robust flavors that you really have to balance in your cuisine and in the actual raw ingredients to make it taste good, because it can become very overwhelming very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's really a switch for me after doing the whole France thing sort of halfway through my career. I realized that just by being invited to go study with a woman in Turkey, I was cooking at a place in Harvard Square called Casablanca, and a woman from Gaziantep, Turkey came in and was having dinner with my boss. And she said, this is really great, but, you know, you got to do some Middle Eastern stuff. Why don't you send your chef to study with me in Turkey? I'll teach her everything. And my boss had a few too many cocktails and he was like, yeah, sure. Sounds great. And then the next thing I knew, this woman was standing there saying that I was going to come to Turkey and study with her. And I was like, wow, Turkey. Oh, my gosh. Genies, flying carpets. I had no idea what to expect. And, you know, when I got there, her friends had prepared this potluck. It was 35 different dishes that were incredibly well practiced, that they, you know, felt really represented what the cuisine of Turkey was. And they were sort of doing this to give me a taste, to sort of open me, expose me to what they felt was really representative of Turkish cuisine. And none of these flavors were familiar to me. Everything was so different. I couldn't understand it. I was so excited. I couldn't even sit down. I just kept like jotting down notes and asking questions. But what I was realizing, what these flavors were so rich, and there was lots of depth, but nothing was heavy. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. I noticed after the fact, because I didn't feel bad. I had essentially tasted 35 different things for lunch. That's a pretty big lunch. And, you know, essentially it was a 35 course tasting menu type thing. And there was this lightness, but yet the food was really rich. And that was really due to the spices. And that's really what sets the Eastern Mediterranean apart from the rest of the Mediterranean, is the use of spice. Not in a heavy way, but using the spices to create layers of richness, depth, without making it heavy. And it's sort of like what wine does in the rest of the Mediterranean. You know, you have this, you know, in Italy, you might have this risotto, and it has lots of umami in it because it has Parmesan cheese and maybe a black truffle if you're lucky. But it's not very dimensional on its own. And the dimensions come from the glass of wine that you pair it with, which is, you know, Barolo, Barbaresco, whatever it is. That's where all the spices are. So it really does, in Middle Eastern cuisine, you're actually cooking in a way that's much more dimensional than in the Western part of the Mediterranean. And I found it to be so interesting, and such a more complex way of understanding food and flavor and cooking.
And you know, they've obviously got some time under their belt. Yeah. And, you know, this is where the origin of agriculture and society came out of, 10,000 years of agriculture in original Mesopotamia, just in southern Turkey and Syria. Mm. And so what must have been unique, and I share an affinity for Turkey, as do you, we've seen what they've been able to preserve with their infrastructure. And much of that is around sourcing. So, you know, it's a country of 77, 78 million people, but they still have over 3 million farmers that are dedicated to much of that, almost what we expect to see within France and Italy, of this Mediterranean diet where we're connected and we still get food within local environments. The Turks still have that preservation and that infrastructure, which you almost take for granted. That's, at least I took for granted. You've been there so many times, you're probably at second nature. But it does seem to, at least from what you're saying, strike to that nerve where sourcing was such an important part of your growing up, that it probably was some parallel. So, and now jumping ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Definitely.
Yeah. And so and jumping ahead now, where I think one parallel that I'd love to bring up, and what I think is so unique about what you do, is your vertical integration of your supply chain currently for your restaurants. So if people are less familiar, you and your husband, Chris, are working, or you've created and operate Sienna Farms, a farm, veg and a produce production farm that's named after your daughter.
Yes.
And you operate this to provide direct sourcing practices of all elevated standards and what you bring into your restaurants for your three restaurants, for your CSAs, and then also for other very high profile chefs within Boston. And I think what I find so intriguing in dealing on the sourcing side, the people that even have an understanding of where they're sourcing practice, never mind vertically integrated, have complete control over it, is so, so rare. So the question is why is knowing where your food comes from so important to you and now to your patrons in this region? Because you've definitely made a namesake for yourself around that. And have you seen an increased trend in people becoming more aware of that, and then also asking about Sienna Farms and knowing more about this and using it as almost a trigger to say, wow, I want to know more about my food stuff, my more product. And you actually have the answer. So have you seen a trend in this direction from your restaurants and from your programs?
Oh, yes. There's no question that people have changed a lot as far as what they're curious about, what kinds of questions they're asking, and what they're buying in general. I mean, that has really changed a lot, and there's a lot more awareness around the subject. But what I find so interesting is it's sort of that theory of the more you know about something, the more you know that there's so much more that you don't know, kind of thing, that can of worms that you're opening. And I love seeing that can of worms open with everyone. I just think it's great. I think it just goes deeper and deeper, and it's starting to get into people's hearts a lot, which I think is, I mean, in a good way, like they're falling in love with how they feel about, you know, shopping at a farmer's market or joining a CSA. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think it does get into their hearts in a positive way too, about it's better for them. Yeah. It's very good. We get rid of the persistent pesticides and the real bad things in food. But I think you're right. Can we trigger this opportunity around people's awareness and interest in food to have them become more of the aficionados? And we've seen it in other categories. And it's even things that aren't as good for us, like cigars. We've got people that really know the nuance of cigars. But really even food categories where we've elevated certain standards like coffee or beer or wine. And I know you focus on all of those aspects of your entire menu. You work on really making sure everything is well orchestrated and mesh and match. But it does trigger upon cuisine, culture, heritage, things that have been a bit lost in our American food side of things.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, now we're seeing folks like yourself, the master chefs, the kind of the rock stars of food, bringing this to people, and it's becoming more mainstream, at least from my perspective. Have you seen this from your peers as well?
Definitely. I think it's becoming almost the norm. And it actually really depends on where you're from, because, you know, in California, it's almost like you don't even talk about it anymore. It's so normal. But in the Northeast, when our season is a little bit shorter and it's a little bit more difficult to thrive as a vegetable farmer, I think, and you have to be a little more creative about you know, how long you grow and the kind of equipment you have and the resources you have, et cetera. But it is it's definitely something that is growing and changing, and like I said, just continues to people are really conscious of who and what, you know, is involved with their food.
Huh. So let's continue on this, because I think the idea of educating the consumer of the importance of food for many reasons, there's values that are, you know, there's so many aspects of values built into food that we've seemed to at least compromised to a certain extent, almost for the cost or how cheap food is. We focus too much on that and not really what the enjoyment, the values, so much of this can come built, that's built into our food and our cuisine. And so one thing that I know you spend quite a bit of time on is focusing on teaching and education. And, you know, you encourage awareness and education for both the art of cooking, but also looking at the importance of dealing with your annual carrot pull that you have at the farm, where you get your consumers to come on. You bring in, I think, both patrons from the restaurant, but also people from the CSA.
Mm-hmm.
So all different delineations and divisions of people from your sourcing practices, and give them a chance to get out and get their hands dirty for a day, see where it's coming from, meet the farmers. A little, you know, unique way of agrotourism, right? And I also know that you're an author of two books. And you have done countless classes and cooking, both cooking and cuisine. You've done traveling tours to Istanbul and Turkey for different charities. And you even had my 11-year-old daughter come into your great, wonderful, world-class kitchen, and you taught her how to do baked Alaska. So it seems that this education part that you're focused on is an essential part of what this differentiation is. And, you know, in the U.S., where we've got 30 million people that experience hunger on a regular basis, and then we also have 40% of our population on the adverse side that's obese. We've either overfed or underfed, and we're losing this opportunity of connecting in between. So leading all up that to the question here is, the role of the master chef, we talk about this of being, you know, the rock stars of food, and you are. I mean, you absolutely are. You're kind of the front line of educating our consumers, our patrons, our population of the value of food. But you also personally, between you and Chris, represent the sourcing side of this. So how can we work better with getting our farmers to be some of the rock stars and our fishermen? And how do we then work with both the fishermen and the master chefs to educate the consumers from both fronts, kind of a ground and air attack on both sides of that? Have you seen that be done successful within your restaurants and your supply chains, or anyone else's that you can think of that you'd like to talk or share some interesting anecdotes about?
Yeah, well, I think farmers are on their way there. I mean, I think I always joke and say, you know, if everything goes well, farmers will be like doctors. You know, they'll be like, you know, who's your doctor? Who's your farmer? Kind of thing. Everybody, you know, people will realize that, you know, spending their money on a little bit more money on, you know, really great ingredients is also a really good prescription for staying, you know, out of the doctor's office kind of thing. And there's so many, you know, for me, my number one priority, and it's really just driven by my passion for my work and everything, is always about flavor. And but I think they also go hand in hand. When you have something that is just full of flavor, bursting with natural sugars, that doesn't need any kind of manipulation, it usually means it's healthier for you. You know, whether it's a burn or a sweetness that a fresh olive oil has, or whether it's the natural sugars that come when you have a fresh milled flour versus, you know, a flour that's old. You know, everything tastes better when it's fresh, and then it also has the optimum nutrition. But I think that chefs are learning by that default, because if the ingredients are better, then they don't have to do as much work to meet their criteria of everything has to taste as good as possible kind of thing. And I think there's a lot of people that are doing great work on all ends of the spectrum, on getting kids more involved, on working with scientists and like Dan Barber is, and creating new seeds that have more nutrition and more flavor, by you know, people just volunteering at their school, or coming out to a farm, or joining a CSA. These chefs are, you know, developing relationships with farmers, making commitments with farmers, which I think is pretty important. There's just so many exciting things that are happening. And I feel like, for me, there's so much optimism, with your daughter's age group. And my daughter is 12, almost the same age. And those girls, those kids, they're amazing. Their life is already so much different than ours was, as far as their relationship to food goes and, what they care about. And I think, you know, I just recently did this class in Napa Valley at CIA. Greystone had a conference that Harvard participated. It was Harvard's conference, but CIA sort of helped host it, and I came out to help teach just some doctors how some fun cooking things. Basically, it was mostly about fun. Just here's what you can do in the kitchen, just so that they could know more to talk to their patients about. And I did one class with a pediatrician that really moved me. She spoke a lot about nutrition for a while. And then I did just some fun cooking stuff to just make it tactile and really make people imagine that they could do this at home, or that they could talk to their patients about, you know, cooking with fresh stuff and why it was important. But I borrowed somebody's daughter who was 14 years old, to help me, because I thought, what's the use of me standing up here doing all this stuff if I don't have a real kid, like, right there with me doing the work, showing everybody that not only can they do the work, but they do a really great job at the work. And so I just asked her, I said, like, what kind of vegetables do you like? And are you interested in trying new things? And she said, I'm much more interested in trying something if I know how it was made, and especially if I made it myself. And I swear that was like, I could have just walked off stage right there. That was all anybody needed to hear.
Drop the mic. Huh?
All right. And then, you know, we proceeded in making a bunch of stuff. And some of the things that we were doing were somewhat sophisticated, as most people might think for a 14-year-old. But the quality of her work was, from my standpoint, you know, is what I'm looking at is the detail of what she's doing. Is she putting the sauce evenly enough on it? Is she seasoning things? Is she folding it right? Is she gonna, is there enough oil, not enough oil? Everything that she was doing was beautiful and can be done by a kid. So that, you know, the kid stuff really is great, and it's easy access. I mean, not everybody has kids, but I think as far as the responsibility that we have to reaching people, it's, we've got an advantage. We can reach them through flavor, through our restaurants, if things taste good, but then to even reach out more to our customers and, you know, bring them back in the kitchen, show them a little bit when we can. It's pretty amazing. People really respond to that, and they get it when they see it and taste it.
It's immersive learning.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because you spoke of a graceful way of phrasing was you said relationship with food. And it is a relationship with food. It's something we all eat.
Yes.
The same amount of food. We're all eaters. So we're all combined. And as Wendell Berry would say, you know, eating is an agricultural act, right? So we have this opportunity to make this more of a systems thinking approach. And I find it interesting because we've done it as consumers. We've done this in other food categories. We talked about wine. I mean, wine is a perfect example of this immersion that we get into going out and having an agritourism event. And once you get into that, you become an aficionado. You're a customer for life. There's huge value. Or someone comes to your kitchen, they are going to remember that. I will remember that for life with my daughter. What an experience we had. So where do we take this to the masses? How do we get more people to have that type of immersive learning? Do we have to put curriculum into our school systems? Do we have to change the approach that we have of treating food differently, that it's not energy, this is sustenance? So what have you seen successfully, both in your work and also just in Outville being a good finger on the pulse, that could bring this type of initiative, which we've seen and probably would be accused of being maybe elitist and to the white tablecloth restaurant? Mm-hmm. How can we bring this to a broader audience so that this is democratized?
Right. I think I sort of have a love-hate relationship with TV, and that a lot of people sit and watch the cooking shows a lot and not actually do the cooking stuff. But then on the flip side, the TV is making it approachable and look good, maybe with the exception of some of the competition shows that can get a little, you know, where people are crying and disappointed and hurt. But I feel like just the continuing exposure, nothing's hidden, telling the story, people just telling their story and having a chance to. Is how we get somewhere. Whether you're telling it to one person or you're telling it to a million, you just tell your story, and that's how it changes. And I think, you know, there's so much being done. Like, how cool is it that you could go to your doctor and then there's like cooking classes to sign up for once a week if you want, and they're free. I mean, there's things that on the nutrition end of the spectrum, people are there are resources to hear people's story. But yeah, I think for me, food and cooking is really a story. It's not, you know, that's the art of it. That's the extent of it. It's not a beautiful painting to look at. It's gone in a second. But it's a story of how it got there on the plate and what was the inspiration behind it. And I think people really want to hear that story. So you just have to be like, you just have to tell it, whether you like the story or not. It's a story. Hmm. So I think people need to, yeah, I think they need to relax a little bit and not be so perfect about everything, and just understand more about, you know, What are you eating? How did it get here kind of thing?
The relationship. Mm-hmm. Never perfect, but we all got them, right?
Right, right.
And I guess maybe that's the trend towards the Instagramming of the food, right? It's so gone so quickly. Yeah. It's an art. It's a piece of art. So capture it, right, I guess.
Yeah. And the critiquing part can be really serious too. You know, like, you know, people are so worried about the critical perfection end of things that they're forgetting that the story is way more important than any of that stuff.
Hmm. Anna, you had mentioned Dan Barber's seed company, Row 7 Seeds.
And, yeah, so cool.
It is so cool. I wonder if you could share with us a bit more of your involvement with Dan and then Michael, is it Masaruk? Masaruk? Masaruk,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Out of Cornell and what they have been working on, focused on different varieties of seeds that are looking at how to bring back flavor, how to bring back nutritional value into our seeds and to do this so that the masses can get their hands on it. I believe that you are one of the 20 hubs that are testing this out and you've been involved in this project for a while. Could you share with our listening audience what is actually going on with Row 7 Seeds and what your involvement both in your restaurants and at Sienna Farms, what you're doing to partake?
Yeah, first of all, I'm hats off to Dan Barber. I'm so excited about this. It's so cutting edge. It's not even funny. I have no idea how he even came up with this idea. And I was lucky enough to be a part of the conference that he organized to just sort of test out the waters on this. And I remember sitting there with Michael, who's a seed breeder at Cornell. And so basically Dan had paired, there were 20, 25 chefs from all over the world, and he paired each of us with a scientist, a breeder. And we just had conversations. And the breeder, I was with Michael, and he asked me questions like, okay, well, what would you like to see in a vegetable? If you could change something, what would that be? And I thought, what do you mean, what would that be? Like, what do you mean I could change something? Like, can I do that? And wait a minute, why would I want to do that? Nature is perfect. And then, but then as the conversation went on, I started realizing, oh, wow, this is really great because we could actually not only bump up the nutrition, we could bump up the flavor. And that was like, wow, how cool would that be? And then we could also make, you know, we could help the farmer's job be easier and we could cultivate something that proves that, you know, that heirloom varieties are not the be all end all, that actually a little bit of manipulation is progress in growth and just change in our environment and everything. And so, I mean, it became this a discussion that was really eye-opening for me. And I ended up saying at that conversation with Michael, I was like, well, you know, my favorite pumpkin is the Long Island cheese pumpkin. It's enormous. A lot of these winter squash and they're really big. And it's really daunting for someone who doesn't cook a lot to take one of these things home from the farmer's market, let alone they got to schlep it around, carry it. Could you make them smaller? And then while you're at it, could you, you know, make it taste even better than it already does? And so it was sort of like it was not a joke, but it was sort of optimistic and sort of dreamy, this whole conversation. And then lo and behold, I don't know, 7-8 months later, I got some Long Island, some miniature Long Island cheese pumpkins in the mail, like a whole case of them. And Michael did them. He did the seeds and sent them. And so he and Dan Barber have been working together for so long and have done some really exciting projects together based on seeds. And I think he was involved in the red egg project too. Egg yolk, where feeding chickens red peppers would turn their yolks red. There were a lot of cool projects that they did. But now Dan has, over the last 3 years or maybe even four, developed these new varietals of seeds. And there, I wish I could tell you exactly how many there are. There are about 7 to 9, something like that, different varieties. And we're going to grow all of them at Sienna Farms and see how they do, see how we we love cooking with them and be a part of this incredibly exciting new wave of breeding and growing. And all of these are things that have been carefully looked at for their nutrition value as well as their flavor, but also little silly things like water content and things that really make a difference on the practical side of how you cook them and, you know, what are the benefits that they will have in cooking time and less water, being sweeter, easier to caramelize faster, things like that. So there's some exciting things happening. I mean, this could change so much for in every aspect, not just flavor and health wise, but, you know, feeding many people and pest resistant things that are great, really great.
Really great is right. And when you speak of manipulation, you're speaking of hybridization, right? You're not speaking of in a test tube or a petri dish, engineering these, but you're talking about a natural process of using and expressing what are intrinsic into these seeds already and just trying to trigger certain feature sets that these plants have based off of different bioregions or different diversity they've been involved in. And is that correct in assuming that?
Yeah, I believe that's how it works. I mean, It's sort of like, you know, they're mutts. They're not purebreds. They're like, you know, they're something that could absolutely happen. So yeah, no, they're not. It's the good side of man manipulation, right. You know?
Yeah, I think, and to get a little bit under the hood, because I find this very intriguing, there's a big difference between engineering of seeds, what's called transgenesis and cisgenesis, which I know you're familiar as well. But for our listening audience, effectively what we've thought of genetic engineering or GMO seeds is a transgenesis approach where we're taking different kingdom feature sets. So whether that's soil bacteria or something from a salmon and trying to infuse that into a seed type, whether that is to make it resistant for a Roundup or a glyphosate or to have a BT enzyme, which is a resistance we'll put in corn to make it a resistant against a certain type of pest that comes in and it would eat the corn seed from the beginning. So the plant's actually growing this pesticide from within. Those are all transgenesis approach. But since going back to Turkey, since Mesopotamia, we have been grafting and hybridization of different seeds that allows us to then take different attributes where nature is that line of demarcation. That's the key driver here. And I think that's where the opportunity, what's so exciting to your point about what Dan's doing. This is really one of the first seed companies, and there are others out there, but it's taking this to the mainstream and introducing this as an opportunity for people to look at man manipulation, but using again nature as our line of demarcation. And what I start get excited by this is when we start looking at what's happened in other locations like Svalbard, which is, speaking of Norway, Svalbard is a seed bank that has been going around the world and basically stockpiling all of the seeds. They have now over 1 million seed types. They have 200,000 types of wheat alone.
Huh.
And they just capture this and they put it in this basic remote island in the frozen tundra way above Norway. And it's our doomsday situation. So if we have a dystopian situation on Earth, we still have seeds to then repopulate the Earth with. And they're looking at this of just storing the seeds. And the guy that started his name is Carrie Fowler. And I asked Carrie, I said, you know, what are you doing to look at what is the capacity of those 200,000 wheat types? Think about what, you know, if they're coming from the Middle East, what the drought resistance that's built into that, what are the origins? What could you do for different propagation or utilization of natural resources or starting to break this down and start to look at hybridization? And they're really not doing much with that yet because all they're doing is trying to focus on bringing it to one central place instead of being lost in a third world country that may have some of the most incredible seed types, but it's being stored in someone's back locker. So what a cool thing. This kicks off a whole different discussion now, right? We got this opportunity. We're looking at it differently. We got the rock stars of food that are starting to embrace this. And this is why I think it's really enthusiastic where we start looking at what early stage adoption and proliferation of these ideas comes from the early adopters, the white tablecloth chefs. And then we can, that can be ported out to the much broader audience. And man, why not here in the States? Let's go back to this idea. We're the melting pot. We got all these cuisines, incredible things. Let's test these out with all these cuisines. This is what American can own for our, what are we known for? What's our food? Well, better sourcing practices, reverting back to this. That's right. At least, is that too, you know, am I way too optimistic with this, Anna?
Absolutely not. I feel like it's changing. I mean, it's changing, maybe not at the clip that we would like it to be changing at, but it's moving. It's changing. It's definitely, I think the next, you touched a little bit upon wheat, but I think that's the next really, really huge can of worms that's going to open, that's just going to erupt. It's going to change everything, I think, for us. Because I think the flavors that come from this, the way of even cooking for Americans could change because of growing different wheats and learning more about wheat and taking the, you know, the bad stigma off of gluten. And I think that it's way overdue. It's been like locked up on an island forever. And we just had this one wheat and it's really hurting everybody. And it's just going to, it's going to erupt and it's going to be a fabulous new experience culinary wise. And I mean, for the art of it, for the taste of it, for the deliciousness of it, but so much for health as well too. So I'm excited about it. It's changing so fast.
It is. And so Anna, I'm going to give you an incredible plug because Oleana was one of the best meals we've ever had. My wife and I went and I took my daughter. It was unbelievable. Please folks, you have to go check out this restaurant. For the best bakehoods, you've got Sofra, and for small plates, you have Sarma. Where else can our listeners find more information about you, your cookbooks, what projects you're working on? Do you have a Twitter handle, a website? Where can people find out more information about you?
Is definitely not my strength. We don't have a huge outsource of all this, but there are webs, they all have websites. Sienna Farms is all throughout Boston. The farmers market Tuesdays and Fridays, and a couple of stores in Boston. The restaurants are in Cambridge. I'm more of an Instagram person. And I try to sort of, you know, I'm at the farm a lot, so you see little aspects, little snips from all the projects that all the places are working on, and that's kind of fun too. But yeah, I think our next focus really is on some sort of outdoor kitchen at the farm where we can do a lot of wood charcoal cooking out there right in the fields and draw in the community a little bit more, because we don't have a farm stand out there, and we do events like the carrot pole that you mentioned earlier, which is really fabulous. And it's sort of like, you know, once people do that, they all of a sudden really like carrots way more than they ever did. And it's a lot of fun. And I think we're looking for other ways to be able to have people experience more of the farm. So we're excited about this new project right now.
And what a difference when you pull that carrot right out of the ground and you just take a quick wash, but you'll still eat it with the soil on it and it tastes even better. Yeah. Whereas then we go to a grocer and we want that thing spotless. It's got to be almost like a coming out of a lab. You know, we lose that perspective. But when you get in the field and you get that experience and you get that relationship,
right?
A relationship with food, which I think, again, you nailed it. So Anna Sartoon, thank you so much for being involved and coming, spending your time on Sourcing Matters. We really appreciate you taking it, and we look forward to having ongoing opportunity to enjoy your restaurants and to continue to learn from you.
Thank you, Aaron. And you're always so inspiring and full of so much information. I could just go on and on, talk forever. Thanks a lot.
Till next time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.